Here are the numbers now. Humidity high at 63%, 71 Kenosha, 72 in Racine. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Well, we're having some trouble playing back the morning show theme, so we'll have to find a new source for that. But in the meantime, let me pull up today's program and welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD. Please stand by. And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We have a busy show for you today with two newly recorded interviews and an interesting interview from the Morning Show Archives. Here's part one. And in this portion of WGTD's Morning Show, I'm really excited to be sitting opposite Brandon Torres, who is the director of the next production of the Lakeside Players of Kenosha, performing at the Rohde Center for the Arts in downtown Kenosha. And the play at hand is Madagascar Junior. And so based on the 2005 animated film from DreamWorks, and it is a load of fun on so many levels, although I must confess this is one animated film on a very short list that I've actually not seen. I've seen just about everything, but for some reason not Madagascar. But I've read reviews, all laudatory reviews, and so I am excited about this conversation about Madagascar Junior, very much based on this hit film. We're going to be talking with Brandon Torres about what it is like to be directing a show like this, and in particular, to be directing a cast of what he tells me is 41 little kids on the stage of the Rohde Center for the Arts. Brandon Torres, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you. I'm really glad to be here.
And before we went on the air, you were telling me a little connection. Not only have we met a time or two at the Racine Theater Guild, but you have a history with my wife, so to speak.
Yes.
Tell our listeners about that.
Yeah, of course. So your wife, Kathy Berg, she was my music director growing up in elementary school.
Well, no wonder you're doing so well now. So, yeah, a great start. So it's great to have you here. Brandon, actually, before we talk about Madagascar, just tell us a little bit more about post-Schulte, where you went to school and the kind of things you've done up until this point.
Yeah, absolutely. So I started theater when I was 5 years old, very young age, and I actually seen a show at the Racine Theater Guild, and I remember watching it, and I was like, oh, I can do that.
Hmm.
So immediately I jumped into acting classes. I ran home to my mom and was like, get me into acting classes.
Hmm.
And the rest is history from there. I grew up at Schulte, and then that's where I actually found my interest in music.
Okay.
Was through your wife. And just seeing her work with these children every day with so much confidence and movement and kept it going.
Hmm.
And each concert choir, I mean, each concert was just amazing.
Hmm.
Amazing. And I think after that, I went into high school with the love of music and theater. I joined the Case High School Choir, mm-hmm. got into Master Singers within my first year there,
wow.
and joined Case Carolers. And in theater, I grew very strong with the director, Nancy Gibson, and she inspired me to become a theater director. And by my sophomore year, I was already assistant directing, choreographing. And here I am today
wow.
at the Rohde Center for the Arts.
Wonderful. So you have Nancy Gibson and Liz Stege and Kathy Berg,
yes.
and probably other teachers as well along the way for fostering this interest you have and talent as well. So how much directing have you done where you're the director, capital
yes.
D?
So believe it or not, this is only my second show where I'm the capital D director.
Okay.
However, being assistant director really helped me build the skill that I needed to work with these kids.
Yeah, right. So we're going to talk now about this production of Madagascar Junior. And so first of all, tell us a little bit about the assignment I mean, the phone rang and did the Lakeside Players come calling, or did you already have a history with the Lakeside Players and did you offer to take this on, or how did this come about?
Yeah, of course. So last Christmas, I directed a Sousified Christmas Carol there, being my first show. I actually went to them and asked them if they needed directors, and I immediately applied for a Sousified Christmas Carol, which is basically a Dr. Seuss reimagination of Christmas. And then I heard rumors that Madagascar Jr. was going to come about. And growing up, I really loved watching this movie. It was on repeat in my house every day. Mm. I would go to, you know, if you remember Blockbuster, I used to go to Blockbuster every week and I would rent this movie and constantly watch it. Even if I had the DVD at home, I would buy that one. That's the one I wanted. And that's the one I'd watch. And when I heard that was the musical potentially for the next year, I was immediately already planning directing before I even knew I was the director.
Wow.
I already created my team. I told them what I was looking for, what I wanted, and the rest is history. I just really went for it.
Wow.
I got the position.
Very good. Well, they gave it to you, and you are making the most of this really fun opportunity.
Yeah.
Probably before we go any further, we need to make sure that our listeners understand just kind of the basic story of Madagascar. And again, it started out with this animated film that you and many, many, many other children really loved with ferocity. And then eventually, of course, it was adapted for the stage. Explain to somebody who has not seen Madagascar, explain the story of these Central Park Zoo animals.
Yes, absolutely. So, as you said, it takes place at the Central Park Zoo, and there we meet Marty the zebra, Alex the lion, Gloria the hippo, and Melman the giraffe, and of course we have some scheming penguins there as well. And while the penguins are plotting to escape the zoo, because they want to go back to Antarctica, they feel they are trapped at the zoo, they tell their friend Marty the zebra, and Marty realizes he feels trapped at a zoo, being enclosed in such a small space. What's beyond the brick wall, you know? Mm-hmm. And he decides he's going to escape the zoo. Now, of course, when he escapes, the other friends notice the hippo, the giraffe, and the lion, and they go after him. And immediately, everything went haywire in New York, and they get shipped to the wild, as people were protesting for, and they end up falling off the ship and landing in the wild and captivating world of Madagascar.
Hmm. So, as you describe that story, there is a little bit of a kernel of something serious, namely animals being
Absolutely.
Kept captive, in a sense, in zoos. Does the story go there very much, or is this mostly a lighthearted romp with not too much of that sort of serious element in it?
You know, when I first read the script, there was no moments where I felt it wasn't really strongly appointed, but I made sure when staging the production that I really made a point to talk about these animals' rights and where they want to go and why they feel so trapped. Mm. I have a group of ensembles being protesters, and they're holding the protesting signs, and, well, I don't want to give too much away. But
wow.
I do intend on making sure that is appointed.
Right. So you're trying to underscore that theme very, very directly.
Absolutely.
So I already made brief mention of what you told me before we went on the air, namely that there are 41 children
yes.
in this cast. Is that the entire cast, or there are some adults in the cast as well?
No, it's all 41 kids up on that stage.
Wow.
They're the running it.
Wow.
They're in the run.
Ranging in age from what?
8 to 18.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wow. So how's the cast put together? We have, of course, those major animals that you already mentioned, but then where do all of these other children figure?
Absolutely. So besides the animals that I already mentioned, there's also going to be lemurs, and lemurs are a animal native to Madagascar, as well as fusa, which are cat-like carnivorous animals native to Madagascar. Mm. The ensemble plays a big part in those two roles, as well as being the New York City people, the protesters, subway announcer. There is probably 30 speaking roles in this production.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. So it's a lot to take on for any director, even a seasoned, experienced director.
Yes.
I mean, I'm just trying to wrap my head around what it would be like to be dealing with first of all, just that many people, but then on top of it, that many children.
Yeah.
So tell us a little bit about what this rehearsal period has been like and what some of the challenges as well as delights have been of working with a cast comprised of so many kids.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I remember my first rehearsal, I was really taken aback because after I cast 41 kids, it doesn't really hit you that you cast 41 kids till they're all in one room talking, right?
Mm.
Over time, it was very difficult. It had a lot of challenges. Making sure they're all focused in is really the biggest challenge. Getting them to all focus in on what I need them to learn that at that time. But we found out what works and what doesn't work. And I really, it's funny because I really sat there and was like, I'm learning things that I thought I already knew. You know, patience, understanding, time, commitment, and it all comes back again, right? It all restarts and resets. Felt like just a little switch in my head just went on. And I really think these children have improved so much personally, developed. They developed really well as children. And it really does take a lot of strength. You have to be pretty, you have to use your voice well to carry it for those 41 kids. And it's also about, I think the hardest thing would be coordinating that.
So how long has this rehearsal period been going on?
It's been going on since August 1st, I believe August 1st. It's been going on, and here we are, down the last week.
Wow. So we should let our listeners know that we're actually recording this on Friday, September 29th.
Yes.
And so people are hearing this on Wednesday, October 4th. So by the time this interview will be airing, you'll be right on the eve of opening.
Yes.
But at this moment, as we are talking, where are you in the rehearsal process? I mean, and what remains to be done?
So what remains to be done is just finishing up costume changes. We just got to dress rehearsals, and we are about to start tech week on Monday next week. And all that needs to get done is just making sure the kids are having all their costumes, make sure the lights are where they need to go, have the sound ready, and there we go. It's showtime.
You, I assume, know this stage really well. Have you acted on the stage of the Lakeside Players? What have you been in?
I have. I was in High School Musical, was my first production there, and I was Troy Bolton. Mm. And then we just did Beauty and the Beast, which was our pretty big sellout show last season, and I played Lumiere.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful. So, there are some challenges to working with that particular stage, and I should think especially with 41 kids, where do you put them all?
Absolutely. Well, it is a pretty small stage, and we work really hard to coordinate who's on stage when, and if they're not on stage, they are either sitting backstage in our very tiny backstage area, or we have a smaller theater right next door, and we usually have that as a green room, as you'd say.
Yeah, good. So all of this has gone well. Have you been the sole director? Have you had an assistant to help you along the way?
Yes, I had a whole team of people. Madeline Wright, my assistant director. Nikki Kohlmeier, my vocal director. Hannah Connor and Caitlin Shores as my choreographers. And then, of course, everyone else at the Lakeside Players have been helping so much along the way.
Fantastic. So by the time this airs, dress rehearsals will be just about done, and this show will then be opening. So what kind of technical challenges does this show pose?
Absolutely. Well, we are the first show at the Rody Center for the Arts to include blacklight.
Ah.
We are using haze, bubbles, and, well, I don't want to give too much away. Just come and see the show.
Right. And see all the visual splendor. Very good. So can you outline when performances are? How many weekends does Madagascar Junior run?
Absolutely. We're running 2 weekends, October 6th through the 8th. We have 7:30 shows on the 7th and the 8th, and then 2 o'clock shows on the 8th and the 7th. And then we are running, what was that, 13th, 14th, and 15th, 7:30 and 2, same times.
Very good.
Week.
and we'll give information about how people can score tickets. It sounds like you've had a good time with this. I mean, this has not scared you away. It sounds like I'm guessing that you are excited to do more and more directing and maybe even widen your horizons in terms of the kind of shows you do.
Absolutely. I'm very excited to see what's after this.
Very good. Brandon Torres, he is the director for Madagascar Junior, which opens this weekend at the Rhodey Center for the Arts in downtown Kenosha. Brandon, best wishes to you and your huge cast and huge crew, everybody involved in Madagascar Junior. Have a great run.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. And I'm excited to have a few minutes with Ariane Zutu, who is senior editor for National Geographic Kids Books. National Geographic is doing an amazing job of bringing to children actually all over the world a wonderful series of books that explore the world in all kinds of intriguing and entertaining ways. Their latest book is so fun, and it is published in order to celebrate the 100th anniversary of Walt Disney Studios. And it's part of their series called Weird But True. And this is Weird But True Disney, 300 wonderful facts to celebrate the magic of Disney. And I have enjoyed this book start to finish, cover to cover, and I'm really excited to speak with Ariane Zutu about it and about other books that National Geographic is producing in this really fun series. Ariane Zutu, we welcome you back to The Morning Show.
Hi, thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be talking about all things Weird But True Disney.
Let's talk first about kind of the overarching series, Weird But True. Do you remember when this was started and kind of the discussions at National Geographic about why a series like this would be worth doing?
Oh, my goodness. I started working at Nat Geo Kids in 2012, and I think this series had already started, maybe like a year or two prior to me arriving, and we've just been blown away. It's just been a smash hit success, and kids eat up these books. They love them. They're just, you know, they're chock full of 300 mind-blowing facts, and each fact just, you know, sparks this thought in a kid's brain, I think, that's just like, wait, what? You know, like an octopus has three hearts. What? So for Weird But True Disney, we definitely wanted to capture that same awe and wonder and really, you know, that same weird but true element in each fact. And I'm happy to say there was plenty of fodder. You know, there's so much that's wow-worthy and amazing about Disney, whether it's, you know, things from the parks or the movie-making magic, or just facts about, heartwarming facts even, about, you know, for example, do you mind if I share a couple facts with you?
Sure, absolutely.
So one of them is, you know, two actors who voiced Mickey Mouse and Minnie Mouse were married to each other in real life. And I think I thought that was so sweet and so heartwarming. And I'll give you another fact. The manatees at the Seas with Nemo and Friends at Epcot eat more than 100 heads of lettuce a day. And we've got an image of a really cute manatee popping in. So they're just really cool facts in this book, facts that I think kids will find really interesting. Some of them are animal related, you know, like they're related to, you know, animals at Epcot or Disney's Animal Kingdom, or maybe, you know, some of the documentaries that Disney has produced. So actually, I'll give you another fact, if you don't mind.
Mm-hmm.
Gino, a silverback gorilla at Disney's Animal Kingdom, celebrated his 41st birthday with a cake made of alfalfa, banana leaves, and sweet potato frosting.
Nice. So take us into
I don't know that I'd want to eat that. Yeah. I think he loved it.
So take us into the process by which a book like this gets put together, because I assume it's not quite the same process as something that's put together that's maybe, I don't know, a little more scholarly in nature. I mean, first of all, how do these facts get assembled? And then how are they chosen in terms of what makes the cut for these 300 wonderful facts about Disney, for instance?
Great question. And you're absolutely right. Putting a book like this together was it's a very different process from our typical process where, you know, we start off, communicating our vision with a writer, and then they turn in a draft, and we've got, you know, fact checkers and expert reviewers reviewing the content. This was a bit different, where we did have a fact checker who was like an independent fact checker, but then we also worked really closely with a bunch of reviewers at Disney, and we went straight to the top. I mean, we were talking to the heads of different departments. They've got people who are in charge of the parks, people who are in charge of Toy Story related content, people who are in charge of princess related content. And, you know, we were really amazed. You know, consumers actually might not know this, but, you know, when we were putting this book together, we were really amazed that people who work at Disney love Disney. And some of these folks that we talked to have worked there for decades, and they just know this stuff in and out. I mean, they didn't even have to consult a database. It's like they just know these facts off the top of their head. And it was really incredible and kind of a beautiful thing, like just how sweet they were and just like how much they love Disney. So, you know, we had the privilege of working with some of these folks, and, you know, so vetting the content was really, you know, a process with the Disney archivist. It was a process with all the different areas of Disney. You know, everyone looked at these facts multiple times. Mm. And, you know, to answer the other part of your question, you know, we might start off with a draft of 300 facts, but, you know, it's a push and pull. You know, as people review, they may say, you know, we've got a better fact, or, you know, images for this type of thing might be hard to get. So, you know, it was an organic process where things might change, and the facts that we ended up with might be slightly different than the initial draft. But, you know, we still, of course, had that, all those different review stages and draft stages and everything. But I think we're all very happy with where we ended up, because this book is, I think We're But You Disney would really delight readers of all ages. I mean, it's aimed at ages 8 to 12, but it's got just something for everyone. You know, there are Easter egg type things. Like if you want to bring this book with you to the park and find the areas we're talking about, you know, for example, you know, the fact that I mentioned about the manatees, you know, eating 100 heads of lettuce a day. I mean, if you go to Epcot, you might even be there in time to see the keepers feed the manatees lettuce. You know, you can just take the book around with you and find these little, you know, these little, the actual real life version of what we're talking about.
And, exactly. And another thing I like is that, yeah, I like the book is relatively small in its sort of dimensions and yet packed with stuff. But I mean, it looks like a book that a youngster could easily hold in his or her hands. And I also like the fact that the book is not only all these facts, but they are produced so colorfully in terms of how they jump off the page with a great eye for design and color and so on. I should think that just putting this book together from a visual point of view had to be a real labor of love and a really fun challenge.
Absolutely. And our designers are amazing. They really take this content and make it so lively and so fun. And we really think of this series in general as being boredom busting. I mean, kids just, you know, they pour over them, and they go through the whole thing, because it's, you know, it's 300 short facts, but they just go back to them again and again, because I think, it just sort of sparks this area of kids' brains where they're just like, it just sparks this awe and wonder about the things in our world.
Mm. I also appreciate the fact, and you've already touched on this, the fact that this book really endeavors to embrace the whole world of Disney and all of the different facets of this company and what they do. So, for instance, it's not just about the wonderful theme parks. It's not just about the wonderful films or the documentaries or the TV series or so on. I mean, you're really trying to touch on a little bit of everything, and not just here in the United States, but also taking a real global approach to Disney.
Absolutely. And one of the things that I think really struck us as we were putting this book together and assembling the facts was the incredible amount of research that goes into each of the films, for example. So, you know, we've, like you've mentioned, we have facts about the parks. We've got facts about the movie making. We've got, you know, facts about places around the world that are inspired by things from Disney. There's really just it really runs the gamut. And I'll give you another fact. So to perfect the wintry scenes in Frozen, filmmakers met with NASA scientist who's nicknamed Dr. Snow to learn how snowflakes form. So it just kind of goes to show the, you know, just how in the weeds these filmmakers got to get everything just right.
Right, the attention to detail. One of my favorites talks about a moment in Toy Story 4, the fourth and maybe final Toy Story movie, and there's a memorable scene that takes place in essentially an antique store or antiques mall. And you tell us that with a little still from the film, there are more than 10,000 items in the antiques mall that Woody wanders through in Toy Story 4. And it's exactly the kind of thing that makes you want to take out your DVD or go to Disney Plus and watch that scene from that film again.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that's the nice thing about Disney is it really, you know, it pulls all their content really pulls at our emotions. I mean, we feel so attached to these characters and to these movies. And I think when you go through the pages of Weird But True Disney, you hearken back to those feelings and to those memories. Mm. And, you know, we've got, you know, facts from movies that are more recent, but also some of the oldies and goodies. And,
absolutely.
You know, I think there's something for everyone.
For sure. Ariana Zutu, editor of Weird But True Disney. Thank you for your time and best wishes to you.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We finish out with an interview from the Morning Show archives, recorded and initially broadcast back in 2010. For anybody who appreciates the beautiful legacy of Fred Rogers and his classic, beloved PBS series, Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, you need to be sure to see a superbly crafted documentary which talks about the legacy of Fred Rogers. Mr. Rogers and Me, a production co-created by two brothers, Benjamin and Christopher Wagner. Benjamin Wagner, who narrates the film, had the opportunity of meeting Fred Rogers back in 2001. His mother was renting a cottage next door, literally, to Fred Rogers in Nantucket, Massachusetts. And what ensued was a friendship, albeit a brief one, because Mr. Rogers died in 2003. But on that initial meeting, Benjamin Wagner and his brother Christopher were inspired to craft a film that would somehow put in context what Fred Rogers has meant in the lives of so many children, and for that matter, adults as well, touched by his very special, loving spirit and about his embrace of the simplest and most basic matters of human life. The result, as I said, is this wonderfully produced documentary called Mr. Rogers and Me, in which they specifically talk to a number of people who work directly with Fred Rogers and who speak so eloquently about his legacy. Benjamin Wagner is with MTV. He is a senior vice president there and a professional musician and has written for such magazines as Rolling Stone. Christopher Wagner has been a producer for Broadcast New York, Monday Night Football, a senior editor at Creative Group. And again, together, they have created a very, very special film. Benjamin Wagner, Christopher Wagner, we welcome both of you to the morning show.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having us and for saying such nice things. Thank you.
I really love the film. Ahead of us talking, actually, about Mr. Rogers, I wonder if you would just say a brief word about this brotherly collaboration and if you have done anything else together like this, or if this marked in some ways a sort of unique and uncommon partnership between the two of you, and what it felt like as brothers to create this film together.
It's actually one of many things that we've produced together over the years, though certainly the most ambitious in scope and will certainly see the largest audience. Chris and I began collaborating as little boys, borrowing our dad's Super 8 millimeter camera and shooting films in the backyard, you know, doing little knockoffs of The Greatest American Hero and Grease. And in fact, some of those clips are in the very beginning of the film. And then later, here in New York City and upstate New York where we live together, we did music videos and we would send video greeting cards to friends and family, music videos for myself and my band. And Christopher certainly edited and produced an immense amount of television, and I've worked at MTV for 15 years, as you mentioned. So, you know, this story was so significant to me personally and such a moving experience that we really just wanted to try and do our best to play a small role in the immense legacy of this just great, great man.
And I would add to that, that I think in a lot of ways it was a culmination of the lessons that I've learned in the last 20 years making television. Like, all the tools that I've gathered over the last 20 years were, in a sense, for that purpose.
Oh, very good. So you could put all these tools to such good use in the making of this film.
Exactly.
Wow.
And I also believe that, you know, if you look at the credits, it's pretty, you know, the film crew was Ben and I. I shot everything. I edited everything, he wrote everything, and did all the traditional producing tasks, you know, making the phone calls and scheduling the interviews. But we, you know, we're brothers, and we are, I think, closer probably than most brothers, but maybe not. And we've always liked each other, but we complement each other very well. We have skill sets that overlap, but I think there's some uniqueness that really creates what I consider to be a pretty powerful dynamic, a dynamic that I haven't experienced with maybe more than a couple of other people that I've ever worked with, and certainly even bigger than that.
And it's, you know, the relationship or the process was actually not just collaborative with each other, and bear in mind that we were working on the movie after our day jobs most of the time between 8 o'clock at night and 2 o'clock in the morning in something of an exhausted dream state. But I think that that behooved the actual experience, because we wanted to let our unconscious be part of the guide, and to really let ourselves be led by things that were invisible to the eye, as Mr. Rogers would say, at the same time doing all the proper due diligence and research to be sure that we were as factually accurate as is possible. But the other collaborator was, in a way, just the experience of the process, not just with each other, but in dialogue with each other, in dialogue with others, and in some way, not to get too esoteric, but in dialogue with something a little bit greater than both of us, where I kind of felt like I would have to, as the storyteller, or in the process of the creating the vision, sort of have to throw up my arms and be uncertain about an outcome or a specific understanding, but that somehow through the process of working together and talking it through, we would come to a new place. And it's worth noting, you know, the film is, you know, ostensibly out in the world now, but I'm still learning from it, and I'm still learning from the process, and I'm still learning from Mr. Rogers. And boy, if you talk about existential gifts, that's about as good as they get.
Sure, and I'm sure he would be so delighted to know, first of all, that the two of you as brothers had this experience as collaborators, and that this film has been such a rich experience for you. Benjamin, I read on the website of the film, and I don't remember if you really say this in the film also or not, but you talk about how the occasion of meeting Fred Rogers on your 30th birthday was, among other things, exciting and also a little embarrassing for you, given what you were doing professionally at the time. It was embarrassment, which Fred Rogers very quickly relieved you of as he spoke with you. Can you tell our listeners what I'm talking about?
Sure. Well, you know, I was a young producer in New York City at the time and had worked a lot of places. And, you know, pop culture in general, in broad strokes, is in a very different place from, say, academia, which as a young man was something I'd always expected to do. I really wanted to be a professor and a creative writer and to be published and to do that sort of thing. So I was at some kind, at the same time, I'm a humongous music fan, as you've gathered, and as Mr. Rogers and I both shared, Mr. Rogers and I performed songs for each other that first afternoon. I think that was the core sort of component of our connection was, you know, I played a song for him that was very meaningful to me because it was my way of working out something that was very difficult, growing up, dealing with my parents' divorce, the uncertainty of leaving college, which was all very recent as it, I mean, maybe it shouldn't have been recent as a 30-year-old, but, you know, it was only 4 or 5 years prior. And Mr. Rogers played for me Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood, and he sang me Happy Birthday. And later I came to learn, of course, that Mr. Rogers used music as a means to express himself as well. So my ambivalence, or my embarrassment, if you will, had more to do with this sort of what I felt as a dichotomy between the broader sort of pop culture world and academia, or sort of larger philosophical thinking. And the great news is that I've come to learn now at the ripe old age of 40 that deep and simple is where you look for it. And it's in everybody. And, you know, I think that's one of the reasons, to your point, that he quickly disabused me of whatever sort of baggage I might have carried into that conversation, that in fact, you know, there are helpers everywhere, and that fundamentally human life is a deep experience, and it doesn't take much to find that wherever you are.
Mm. For those of you just joining us, we're speaking with the Wagner brothers, Benjamin and Christopher Wagner, who together have created a wonderful film, a documentary called Mr. Rogers and Me, which in addition to airing on PBS, is now available on DVD and through iTunes, and is a film that should not be missed, especially for anybody who remembers Mr. Rogers and his great legacy and wants to revisit what made him such a special and indeed irreplaceable presence on television. The heart and soul of your film are these conversations which you had with a very interesting array of people who were either friends of Mr. Rogers, in a couple of cases, literal, actual neighbors of his, people who worked with him or who collaborated with him or who admired him and wrote about him, including a couple of people I had the honor of interviewing on my own program, the late Tim Russert, for one, and also Tim Madigan, the author of a very touching book called I'm Proud of You. I guess I would like to start by just asking how you assembled this particular group of people to speak with, since probably half the planet would have been eager to share the recollections of Mr. Rogers. How is it that we hear from these particular people, and how did you connect with them?
Sure, and it's worth noting that everywhere we go, we do have those conversations, and we get them on our Facebook page and on our website, and it's so gratifying that Mr. Rogers and me is Mr. Rogers and all of us. That's pretty profound. But in terms of the film, you know, it's structured as a road trip is the modern term, but the hero's quest would be the sort of academic or, you know, literary term. And it really was that. We set out to meet and speak with and learn from Mr. Rogers' friends and neighbors. And the media world was one that was we're in, so that one came naturally. So our first few steps were first going to Bo Lozoff, who Mr. Rogers and I had been discussing, so that was a natural person to speak with. Amy Hollingsworth had written a book and just published it that, of course, like Tim Madigan's explores, and like this film, explores the relationship that she'd had with Mr. Rogers. It's called The Simple Faith of Mr. Rogers. And from there, we got into the media world through Tim Russert, who I had read an article by his wife, Maureen Orth, in the local paper one summer. So I knew that they had had that contact with Mr. Rogers, but also knew that Tim Russert is, you know, top of the class in terms of really cutting through the chatter in Washington and creating clarity through a real approachability and a simplicity. So, you know, he was you can imagine how anxious I was to do that interview as a young journalist, but he was super approachable and very warm and very lovely. And from there we went to Susan Stamberg, who is someone Chris and I deeply admire as a broadcaster, didn't really have quite an idea of just how deep and longstanding her relationship with Mr. Rogers was. That unfolded in real time before our eyes as we spoke with her. Hadn't even seen the episode in which she and Mr. Rogers discussed divorce, and specifically discussed the difficulty of flying for young children when their parents are divorced, something that was a real tough one for me and Chris growing up and shuttling between our divorced parents. And, you know, there was a lot of that kind of serendipity and synchronicity. In many ways, the road unfolded before us, and one person would lead to another, or a little bit of reading would lead to another, or a little bit of, sort of research would lead to another. And the road unfolded before us. You know, we could be still telling this story today and interviewing great people who had been impacted by Mr. Rogers. This, you know, we did a little MOS on the steps of the Smithsonian, and everybody had a memory, a story, something profound to share about how they'd been impacted.
Right. One of the film's sort of abiding themes revolves around the many small yet tremendously thoughtful gestures in which Fred Rogers engaged, and the kind of things that you feel like none of the rest of us would ever think of this, and yet he, being such a thoughtful man on so many levels, would think of these things. Two of my favorites actually come from the interview you did with the late Tim Russert, talking first about a little gesture he did with Tim Russert's young son, Luke, just a little one-on-one gesture of friendship that you can tell us about. And then about that matter of the signed photograph, the autographed photo that that he gave to Luke later. I wonder if you would share those two lovely little moments with our listeners.
Sure. Mr. Rogers and the Russerts spent summers or portions of their summers on Nantucket, a little quiet little corner, peaceful little corner called Mattakin. And they had an annual picnic, the neighborhood, kind of a Thanksgiving in the summer so that all the families could get together. And Tim tells this story that he was filling his plate with quote-unquote Thanksgiving dinner, and he looked around to see Luke and Mr. Rogers sitting on the floor together. And Mr. Rogers had taken a paper plate and had put some fasteners on it and little numbers to teach Luke how to tell time. So, you know, here in the midst of all this adult behavior and all this adult activity, Mr. Rogers finds the only young person in the room and instructs him, which sure feels like the Mr. Rogers we all grew up with.
Right.
And later, Mr. Rogers and Luke had taken a photo together, as so many of us did with Mr. Rogers. He also took lots of photos of other people. When I was at his house, not only did I pose for a photo with him, but then he shot photos of me, and it was something he did apparently quite a bit, as you get an inkling of in the film. But Luke Russert had a photo taken with Mr. Rogers, and later that photo was sent back to the Russert family with a signature on the front, and on the back a note to Luke that says, "To Luke, through the kindness of his father, who in essence made this experience possible." So even in that note on the back, reinforcing the value and import of the relationship between parent and child.
I love that. I also love photographer Beverly Hall, who would be one of Fred Rogers' real-life neighbors in Nantucket, telling the story of how either on 9/11 or the very next day, Fred Rogers quietly knocked on the door. Maybe he and his wife were both there, I don't recall, but just wanting to connect with neighbors in the wake of that terrible catastrophe. Christopher, I wonder if you would actually mention to our listeners about what I think is a special moment when we see Fred Rogers receiving a particular broadcast award, and the surprising thing that he did up on the stage. You end up sharing this moment with us as we watch the documentary, and I think it says so much about Fred Rogers. Do you remember the moment I'm talking about?
Certainly, yeah. That was pretty incredible, and something that I think, I aspire to being respected to that level by my peers. But what was most amazing about it was the fact that I don't think there's anybody else in the television world that could have gotten the Emmys broadcast to hold for 10 seconds of silence. Unbelievable. And you certainly wouldn't see that today. I mean, and I assume in radio, silence is deadly. Same on television. But no one stopped him. And today, they cue the music and they pull you off stage. It was just an incredibly powerful moment. And also, he was a recipient of tons and tons and tons of awards. I mean, but he still had that presence to just honor. And the words he said, and I won't do him justice, I'll just hope that people would watch the movie to see that. And you can probably find that clip online as well. But he took it away from himself, which he seemed to always do. It wasn't about Fred. It was about everybody else. And that was also just such the way from all of the people that we talked to and all of the footage that we went through, it seemed like it was never about him. He was so humble, and so it was about everybody else and the people, which is a great lesson. The people that helped us become who we are was the essence of his speech. Let's take a moment. Let's take 10 seconds to think about the people who loved you and cared about you and helped you to become the person that you are today.
I mean, right.
That's an amazing concept, and most of us don't take 2 seconds to think about that. But if you do, you're like, wow, there's a lot of people that helped me become the person that I am today, in small ways, in big ways. Of course, our parents, but there's a lot of other people, teachers, friends, colleagues.
Hmm. And, of course, it was a moment not only to do that, but it was also a moment of silence, which one of your guests says, and we just don't have enough of in our lives, and children in particular. And, of course, one thing that people so deeply appreciated about Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood was what a quiet place it was, in addition to a loving and welcoming place. And if there is one theme that rings out more than any other, and I think it's restated so beautifully by a variety of guests in your program, it is that notion that that we are beautiful just as we are, and that notion that he loved to say again, I like you just the way you are. One of your guests says it particularly well, that we just don't hear that enough in our modern society. I mean, in this era of the biggest loser and all kinds of other things, we're made to feel like we're not thin enough or not glamorous enough or not successful enough. And there's always some way in which we should be reshaping or remaking ourselves. Speak a moment about this fundamental facet of who Fred Rogers was and what he shared with the world.
Well, I can just tell you how powerful that was for me personally. You know, it may seem unusual for me to say this, but hitting 30 years old, there's a passage there, right? You're really entering adulthood. It's why the "don't trust anyone over 30" phrase comes from, right? So to meet Mr. Rogers on that day for me, to really be wrestling with the loss of adolescence and who am I and what is my purpose, what is my value, you know, what is broken in me and how do I fix it, how am I inadequate and how do I become whole. And what Mr. Rogers began to teach me on that day and has continued to teach me through the making of this film is that I am whole, I am enough, and that we are ultimately fundamentally enough by just being who we are. And that's powerful stuff. And, you know, it's one of the reasons, no spoilers, we end the film with one of the beats that we do in terms of my own personal growth and development, RE, my own life. It, you know, Mr. Rogers helped us all grow up, and not just to become 10-year-olds, but, you know, to become young adults and adults and to have tools to make us deeper, simpler, you know, more capable of contribution, you know, adults. And that is about the greatest gift of all.
I don't remember who said it, if it was Fred Rogers or one of your guests, but somebody said, simple is not the same as easy. And so the fact that Fred Rogers kept it simple through his career is not to say that he did something easy. He did something that very few of us know how to do nearly as well as he did.
Yeah, simple requires, I think, actually a significant amount of effort to really focus on, you know, the essential components of what you're doing, whatever that is, building a sophisticated vehicle of some sort or a poem or a painting. Simple is, you know, somebody said this great thing the other day. I was in the context of my work. Somebody said it would have been shorter if I had more time, which is kind of a production phrase. The idea that, in fact, being concise, being clear, being simple, being absolutely essential is very hard work.
Hmm.
And that in itself is significant and profound as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, I must say that the two of you have achieved that in crafting this beautiful film, again called Mr. Rogers and Me. Benjamin and Christopher Wagner, congratulations to you both, and thank you for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about your beautiful film.
Thank you so much. You honor us, and we just appreciate it so much. Thank you.
The documentary film Mr. Rogers and Me can be streamed on Amazon Prime Video, and it can be rented on Apple TV. A minute before 9 o'clock now here on WGTD. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, you'll hear the interview that I just recorded yesterday with best-selling author Liz Wiseman, talking about her book Multipliers, one of the best books I've read on effective leadership. Liz Wiseman is one of the special guests who is coming to Kenosha on Friday, October 13th, as part of